Okay, so next we'll move on to agenda paper 3 on ceding commissions, on reinsurance contracts, and also on reinstatement premiums. This paper was reposted, so just to be sure, we are looking at the version which has the little box on the front saying so. We received a number of submissions describing common types of ceding commissions, and those submissions included examples of commissions that are contingent on claims and also on some commissions that are not contingent on claims. The submissions ask whether those commissions are considered to be part of the premiums or part of the claims in the financial statements of the reinsurer. The submissions also ask whether all or some of the amounts related to those ceding commissions meet the definition of insurance acquisition cash flows or of an investment component. As well as reinsurance commissions, the submissions also ask about reinstatement premiums and how they're treated in the financial statements of the reinsurer. And this paper includes separate analysis for mandatory reinstatement premiums and voluntary reinstatement premiums. The analysis in Agenda Paper 3 focuses on the economic effects of each type of ceding commission and reinstatement premium, and considers whether the economic effect is equivalent to charging a different premium or reimbursing a different amount of claims. So with that, I'd like to ask TRG members for your views on the analysis in this paper.
Thanks, Laura.
I'll just talk about commissions and then the reinstatement separately. On the commissions, it's hard to argue with the logic of the outcomes of the paper in terms of where it gets to. Having said that, I think it's worth emphasising the implementation difficulties around this. So as a reinsurer, at the moment you're accounting for things as commission based on your legal contracts and your business model. In the future world, you'll be deconstructing that commission down to adjust your premiums, potentially deposit components, and also adjusting against your claims. So there's a significant implementation practical difficulty around that. Having said that, in reinsurance contracts, there's lots of different types of commissions that exist, and I think possibly this is an opportunity for simplification of some of that. So I think in the general insurance and reinsurance world, we've tried to look at the business model and apply IFRS 17 over the top of it. In this respect, it's probably where we need to come and meet IFRS 17 and actually look at some of the contracts and the way that they're set up and see if there's a simpler way through this. A consequence of that implementation change and difficulty is you're suddenly looking at your reinsurance world and your commissions in a very different way to perhaps other gaps and also to the Lloyd's market here. So that will cause a lot of practical difficulties having to run two sets as effectively of accounting. On the reinstatement premium, that was the one probably that we had the most discomfort with, because a lot of the metrics around looking at your reinsurance, both inwards and outwards, are around loss utilization, where you're comparing your exposure against your claim. Once you start to account for your reinstatement premiums within your claims, you're sort of distorting the metrics that you use. And in my mind, anything that moves you away from a business model to a statutory accounting is actually going to make it harder to talk about your results to your users and your investors. So we didn't really like that. But again, I haven't come up with a good argument as to why you shouldn't do that. So within the framework of the standard, I can see how it works. It just isn't the way that people look at this business now. So I think there's a lot of practical issues here.
Okay, so you basically agree with the staff analysis, but you don't really like it. Kevin?
I had a few points to make, so forgive me. I think, tying in with Martin, you said to us up front, we should be saying, is this what we think the standard says? And then giving the operational consequences later. I think I'd agree with Anne. You've provided a very clear and helpful analysis of what the standard says, and I agree with that. And I think the core paragraph for me of what this paper is saying is 22, where you basically say that, the clear requirements that you've got in paragraph 86 of IFRS 17, which says that for reinsurance held, for the cedent's perspective, you give guidance on how to determine whether something's premiums or claims, that should apply equally to reinsurance issued, so from the reinsurer's perspective. And I think the rest of the paper then is just a kind of application of that principle. So I think that's very clear and that's helpful. One of the things that the paper did as well, which I'm not sure I was sure was the interpretation, and I guess interesting to hear if others felt this as well, is where you said that when you determining whether something is an investment component or not, it needs to be the amount that's repaid in all circumstances. So it's not just if you have zero claims, it's also if you cancel the contract. Mm-hmm. And I think that's helpful clarification, because I think it could be read, you know, either way, and I'm quite keen to hear what others think about that. I think it might help in making some things that we thought were investment components not be investment components, so it might go some way to addressing the operational concerns that Anne mentioned. Then the other point that I had was someone raised to me, a reinsurer raised to me the fact that they weren't super comfortable with the distinction between the voluntary and the mandatory reinstatement premium, and actually said that they even thought that the way the mandatory one was explained here was not how it works for them in practice. So they said that even with the mandatory reinstatement premium, you often are buying extra coverage because your limit goes up. But I think that the principle that you keep coming back to is this claims dependent or not? And if it is, you do one thing. If it isn't, you do the other thing. And I think that it's implying to me that the distinction between voluntary and mandatory reinstatement premium would equally apply to the cedent as to the reinsurer. So I think it's you're trying to do the same analysis, and I think that's clear. I think my final point then was just in the flow chart, this is on page 18, A1, it starts out by saying, this is how you're going to determine whether exchanges for a reinsurer and a cedent, whether they're part of claims or not. The first question is the amount contingent on claims? I.e., does the amount change because of the occurrence or non-occurrence of claims? And if you answer yes, then you say it's part of claims. But I think if we go back to the mandatory reinstatement premium, you're saying that there's a difference between the mandatory and voluntary. So the one is claims, the other one isn't. So I think we may just need to change that here, because I think the reinstatement premium amount is always contingent on the claim. But then sometimes it's going to give you, extra coverage, and sometimes it's not. So I just think the flowchart maybe can be a bit more clear, because it seems as soon as you say yes, you go into mm-hmm. contingent on claim.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Leslie?
I'm not an expert in reinsurance, but when I was reading this, I was struck by whether these principles or the same logic would apply to experience-rated group insurance contracts, where an amount is effectively refunded to the policyholder if claims are below a certain level. When I was first reading the paper, I thought, no, those payments are contingent on the amount of claims, because the more claims you have, the less of the refund that you get back. But when I was reading the analysis of the commissions, I realized, no, you think that's not contingent on claims, because the policyholder gets back some combination of claims and experience rating to a minimum level. And then they get more than that if the claims burn through. But that would be a significant change in the way we think of and look at experience-rated group contracts. Effectively, we would have no revenue and no claims unless the experience rating basis is burned through. So I wasn't sure the paper was meant to apply to that. Paragraph 22 seemed to say that, or paragraph 21 seemed to say that IFRS 17 doesn't have requirements about whether amounts are premiums or claims for direct insurance contracts. But then paragraph 35 seemed to say that it was pulling in experience rating for commercial line contracts. Then my terrible imagination took that even further to individual participating insurance contracts, where we have almost a profit sharing. But I had to stop short and say, okay, answer me that. Was this meant to change the way we present experience-rated group contracts so drastically?
So, Leslie, I would just say that I think that thing that says that if you don't pay back the experience refund if the thing is cancelled, which presumably you don't, then it's not actually an investment component. So in your case, you're
I'm not worried about investment component or not. That part didn't bother me. I saw that that was just about the timing. In other words, if the premium is up front and then I refund some, it's an investment component. But if I true up at the end, it's not an investment component. I don't care about that. It's actually what I'm calling claims. Like, this would suggest that I have no claims unless I burn through the experience rating basis.
I think
and that's
sorry, but
I can't follow. It's different. I think we cannot discuss any kind of new fact patterns or different fact patterns. And because people don't have a paper, don't see what is, and then, okay, maybe come to the wrong conclusion.
Oh,
that is difficult, and we should really not do that.
I think the problem would be that we don't necessarily know, firstly, exactly what the type of product you're talking about, and secondly, whether that product is similarly applied wherever you look at it. And buzzwords can be very dangerous in any industry, and insurance seems to be particularly so. So I think what we'd probably say is that I think you would need to read these paragraphs and see whether they apply to other similar contracts. But I think as a TOG, we should be very cautious of
definitely the analysis was not limited just to reinsurance contract issue. This should be applied equally to insurance contract issue because it's, at the end of the day, it's looking at the economic effect of the transaction, taking this another level to look at specific fact pattern is something that needs to happen after this meeting.
Francesco.
Thank you. First of all, I wanted to say that I agree with the analysis across all the different elements of the paper. When we discussed this paper in the Hong Kong Insurance Implementation Support Group, and I have given my personal commitment to the members of that group to raise some points that they feel should be raised here. They asked me to point out that it appears, although they agree with the conclusion, that there isn't a direct reference to the literature in IFRS 17 for some of the conclusions that have been reached, and they wanted to check whether that is something of a procedural nature that the staff may want to explain in the public so people understand how sometimes to reach the conclusion that is documented in this paper for other instances that may come in the future. There is an expectation that if we hear that explanation, then people may actually find a way to apply IFRS 17 in other situations more effectively, and that can help the process of adopting it.
I think for this one, Kevin actually provided an answer. So obviously, always when we have a submission and we look at analysis, we look at the words in the standard. When the words in the standard do not accommodate specific facts and circumstances, as would be expected because this is requirements of the standards and principles, we try to look a bit further. Here we looked at the requirements that we have for the presentation of revenue or income and expenses related to reinsurance contract. The basis for conclusion explains there that you need to look at the economic effect. Economic effect is something that should be applied equally, so it seems sensible. I don't know if you can read any other words or the words that we have differently. So I thought that Kevin's point was actually answering this concern.
Okay, so second. Sorry, John.
Yeah, I have 2 points to note here. One is to, firstly, to echo comments from Anne as to the operational complexity from the kind of cash flow, reinsurance cash flow analysis based on whether they are contingent on claims, because what is presented here is not the the usual common market practice here. Having said that, it may not be necessarily a bad thing because it may drive a simplification in reinsurance contract in the future. The second point I want to note is concerning the issue raised by Leslie. I need the word search on the word contingent on claims. It only appear, in the standard, only appear for reinsurance cash flow. So I caution extrapolating what it say in this paper to other businesses here, because for other businesses, you need to take into account the fact and circumstances you know, this paper is concerning reinsurance, and it should stay that way, in my view.
Okay, thanks, Vasilka.
It might be a matter of interpreting the fact pattern, but what I wanted to raise here is to do with the analysis related with reinstatement premiums, and also hear what the rest of the members of the TRG that are coming from industry and have similar contracts, you know, think about it, because the way that I read the pattern, and also using kind of knowledge and experience from how, you know, these contracts look in practice, the way that it works is you've got a limit, which is the initial limit, let's say £100, and you've paid a premium for it under a catastrophe cover of 20. You incur claims that, let's say, burn into your limit. For example, you incur a claim of an 80, it goes against the you know, limit of 100, and the terms, as per the case that we've got, force you to reinstate the 80. So to me, the way that it looks is, if it were just the claims deductible in a contract, what it would do is it would reduce the claim that the reinsurer recovers, but the deductible would not give you the reinstatement of the coverage and the ability to claim further 80 once you've paid the premium. So the way that I interpret that scenario is that you are buying additional coverage, you are getting additional limit. And this is where I was slightly uncomfortable with the analysis, because to me, it is buying coverage, you are reinstating coverage, and that's premium. Because if it were not a reinstatement premium, if it was just a claims deductible, you will not have the right for the extra limit usage. And I mean, I welcome what the industry says, because I'm pretty sure that they will have, you know, cat covers, and that's very common in industry, and that's how they, you know, they are rated. You know, most often you've got probably one or two reinstatements for free, and then you have, in order to increase the cover and to continue recovering claims, you have to pay the reinstatement premium. So that's why I was going to want it to, because if you follow that same logic, then why are you treating the initial premium as premium? Because it just uses the first limit. So why are you treating it as a premium?
Okay, Sally.
Okay, thank you. Because I'm not from reinsurance, and the business in our side company is also small, and I think most of people here are not from reinsurance company. But the reinsurance company in China, when we discuss this, they raise a big concern, as what happened in Hong Kong as well. I heard that. Say it's totally different from current practice, and they don't see the wordings in the standard. So I can read through, I can understand the logic, and it's quite clear to me, and the economic impact on that. But for them, as they read wording by wording from the standard, it's not there at all. So they argue that why they need to follow these requirements when it's not required in the standard. And also, I think if it's the case and they will agree, they might impact significantly on the current experience, and they probably will change the contract term and the way they do business with the cedings. So it will have a significant impact on that. And if so, I think that we need to have some education material to the market to make sure all the reinsurance company will buy in the idea, and to make sure they do the things right. And also, I also echo Leslie's questions. When we read this is a principle, actually it's a judgmental and a principle basis judgment when we look at the reinsurance contract. So we also have to concern whether we need to apply the same judgment and concept when we look at other contracts like group company, group contracts, and also PNC contracts. They might have similar arrangements. So if that's the case, we need to come back to look at our current practice, because it might have impact as well.
Yeah, but and hopefully this discussion helps them, okay, to read the words, how the staff has now in an analysis, because, man, it's not come practice is not our words. Come practice is something different. And clearly, mind, if it is not aligned with come practice, okay, that maybe is an issue with, okay, implementation, cost, whatever. But I have not heard any voice saying, okay, that is not how it should be read. Roman.
Yeah, thank you, Martin. I can echo a little bit what Sally said, that some reinsurers have issues with the interpretation, and I think one argument which I think is convincing, that by the way we, for example, treat then the sliding scale commission, and in the example here, that we net then any claims related commission to the claims, you somehow overshadow the overall information on claims. Because of this netting in an extreme manner, you would not anymore get a real information about what is really the claims development, because you mix it up with the premium, or here in this case, and commission information. So all, I think, the figures which you usually take for analyzing then profitability of P&C business, like a combined ratio, might get heavily distorted. And connected to that, I was not so clear, maybe I missed it in your introduction, why there was a reposting of the paper. I think the initial paper on the sliding scale commission, you said, okay, the minimum amount of the sliding scale commission needs to be also deducted from the premium, and now I think it's a maximum amount. And if I go to then an extreme scenario, saying, okay, in if there's zero claims, the maximum sliding scale commission is equal to the premium, then I would net more or less everything. So I can put up, I think, contracts with just very extreme, an extreme scenarios. I know always, okay, whatever loss ratio is between 60 and 70%. However, I come up with a scheme which is going even beyond what is explained here in the example, saying, okay, if it's below 20%, the commission is 100%, for example. If claims ratio is below 20%, commission is 100%. And the resulting presentation, I would say, is not any more really meaningful.
But in this case, if there are no claims, you wouldn't expect to see claims, would you?
I think it's an absolute impossible fact pattern that there are zero claims.
Maybe it's good not to discuss impossible fact patterns.
Yeah, I think
it's all confused.
Maybe the point I make, I think this is maximum sliding scale commission. The question for me is, if is this really always the maximum? If there is no substance at all to such an arrangement, that you have a 90% commission, for example, if your claims ratio is below 10%. You know, claims ratio will be always between 60 and 70%. You insure a large portfolio, so zero claims is impossible. In fact, it's, from a substance perspective, it makes no sense to treat then 90% of the premium as claims-related commission. That is the point I would like to make, but maybe you've thought about that, and maybe you can clarify why you somehow there was a different line of arguments in the past with the minimum sliding scale commission, now with the maximum, because with the minimum we could avoid that issue I saw, but maybe I just oversaw or something.
Well, when we posted the paper initially, we had an error with this example. So we have three examples total in this paper that talk about those kind of commissions that are, their title is that they are contingent on claims. Two of them are included in the appendix, and they apply the requirements as we see them. So they look at the economic effect. We had an error with this one, and we fixed it when we reposted the paper. So I think that what we are saying in this paper is that we've got the requirements. This is what we have in the standard. We now need to make a decision on those amounts that are exchanged between the parties. We can either look at their title and say, okay, if it is commission, it is one way, or if it is range statement premium, it's premium because it is range statement premium. That's the name, which does not seem to make sense. And then we can look at the economic effect of things. We chose, and I think it's sensible, to look at the economic effect of the exchange between parties. That should apply to reinsurance contract issues, to insurance contract issues. We should always look at the economic effect. I don't see how you can end up in different situations. I can imagine, if I follow your thread, that there could be extreme situations that you might see different things, but it's not at this table. And I guess for that point of the ratios will be different. Yes, they will, but, you know, this is part of implementing a new standard. And, yeah.
If I can, so I think fully agree. I think it's a new standard, so all the KPIs will look differently. Yeah. The question is if they are then still meaningful, and with this topic I have some doubts. I think that we lose maybe some information, especially I think if people then use the guidance we provide here with the THG, maybe to really come up then with extreme contract types to somehow influence certain ratios. That is a bit what I read out of that of the CAT. I could imagine what would be not so possible if I go on the maybe expected sliding scale commission or the minimum like in the past, but I see the line of arguments, but I see some consequences which from a practical perspective I'm not so happy with, not in terms of implementation effort, but just in terms of how information then is presented.
In extreme scenarios I can disclose it. Kevin.
I'm just coming back with a comment related to what Vasilka said. One of the reinsurers made the point to me that when it comes to reinstatement premiums, if they've got a contract and they're applying the general model, they have to make an estimate of what premiums they're going to be getting in future. And so they put both voluntary and mandatory in there and make an assumption about it. And I guess it then probably just makes it a bit difficult to distinguish between those two and say when is one claim, when is one not a claim. And it's premium, and that kind of goes back to your point, which is we're pretty clear that the upfront bit is a claim, but is a premium. But then when we have a voluntary or mandatory reinstatement premium, we're saying it's a claim because it's related to the claims amount, but it could actually be buying you more coverage or an extension.
Right? It is buying, because once you've used the 80, once you pay, you are allowed to use further 100, a new 100. Not just 20 or anything, so that's why it is allowing you more capacity.
So I just feel that maybe that just means that it's not as clear as here. And you know, you are saying the principle is it claims dependent or not? Apply that, but I think it might just be that this the reinstatement premium, voluntary, mandatory stuff may just still be a bit unclear. We need to think about a bit more.
And also looking at the pricing factors for these premiums, you know, they are looking at the burning costs. And when you speak to a pricing actuarial underwriter, they agree, yes, they are related to claims. They say they are correlated with the claims. And, you know, also the other thing to bear in mind is that very often in, you know, the real life scenarios, what happens is for that first layer, you are paying a kind of preliminary premium. And then once at the end of the contract, it is clear what is the total volume of exposure that you have underwritten that has been protected by that contract, you actually adjust the rate based on the rate online, even the first premium that you have paid, and then for any reinstatement that you have paid further on, you recharge again based on the underlying exposure coming in. So, you know, the pricing people view that this is the price for me to continue providing your coverage and paying claims once you've exhausted the first limit.
So what I think my only response to this and what I've heard so far is that there's no disagreement with the principles as explained in this paper, and they need to be applied carefully to facts and circumstances. What I've learned spending just more than a few years with the insurance industry, that reinsurance contracts are the most complex type of contract.
Agreed.
I've seen. So definitely careful analysis of all facts and circumstances, but I do think that the principles of looking at economic effect of the total cash flows, ignoring the titles or intentions on what we thought we would expect or what we do currently, is what we need to follow.
I'm not questioning the principle. I'm kind of If I'm raising a concern, it is the application of that principle in the context of that specific scenario that we had, but we've discussed it. I have just one more point that I wanted to kind of bring for the attention and probably a question for you guys because you've developed the examples. I can see that in all of the examples, when you are calculating, you know, all the numbers that come out of it, all the kind of claims ratio commissions, you're working with the gross premium as opposed to the premium after the deduction of the commission. What is the kind of conceptual logic?
All the numbers and all the examples that we have here are based on submissions that we received. Okay. We didn't made up any number. Understood. This is how we got the numbers.
Yeah. So. Because I think what I wanted to flag here is that what that means, again, you know, I appreciate it's a practical, operational application matter, but it cannot be ignored, is the fact that it means that the reinsurers will have to keep a set of cash flows and a set of data based on the gross premium and the actual claims payments that they make, because they have to calculate a loss ratio. This loss ratio drives the commission, and as a result, all these drive the total amount that they pay. And on top of that, you know, anytime they pay something to the policyholder, they have to identify which part of it is potentially an investment component, if there is an investment component. So all that makes it extremely, extremely operationally complicated, and it requires keeping two sets of data to make it work operationally.
Dara?
So I'd wanted to pick up on something that you did say, Hagi, but I think it's really important to emphasize. It seems particularly when it comes to reinsurance, you have to look through the labels to understand the underlying economics, because there's not always representative. I think the other thing is to emphasize the fact that the responses here are to the examples we have raised, that we were presented with. And I think we need to be careful of trying to interpret beyond what's in the examples we were given. And then the third thing is I'm sort of starting to understand why a couple of the earlier people commented that hopefully this will lead to a simplification of reinsurance contracts.
Yes, thank you. So I agree with the facts and the paper and the analysis that's been done, and I do understand the operational consequences. So I think just having had this discussion hopefully has made more people aware of that, because I don't think people are looking through the labels at the moment, and I'm not sure whether that there's more education needed, because I think that's quite important. I just wanted to come back on the comment, I've forgotten who made it, about whether this applies to direct contracts, because when we had our discussions, we had concluded that this, and I think you say in paragraph 35, you talk about features common in reinsurance contracts and some other commercial line contracts, because I think the logic does hold. So I'm slightly concerned some people are saying this is only reinsurance, because I'm not sure I take the analysis to say I can restrict it. I think it does have knock-on consequences. So I wouldn't want people to go away thinking it's only reinsurance.
I think the general line we have is that reinsurance issued is insurance issued. Reinsurance held is reinsurance held.
Massimo?
I think I interpret that this is based on the fact pattern presented that relates to reinsurance. So I think that we should think at the exchange between cedent and reinsurer. And I agree that it's good to have the fact that we should have consistent treatment from the cedent part and the reinsurance part, looking at the economic underlying, rather than the specific labels, the specific wording of the contract that are very different one each other, especially once we talk about reinsurance. So I agree in general with the paper, but I take also the point of Vasilika and Kevin about restatement premiums, in the sense that of course, looking at the economic principle behind, I think that we are talking about something that is more related to the acquisition of coverage in both the case, mandatory and voluntary. And this probably will also simplify the application, so to have a consistent treatment of restatement premiums, regardless if they are mandatory or voluntary, and so also in the context of simplifying, I think that could be more consistent and easier, this kind of representation. The other topic that I guess it's very complex is the taken in the paper once consider the cash flows and investment component, a non-distinct investment component. And I think that the point that Kevin suggested about it is something that should happen also in case of cancellation of the contract helps. In reducing probably the case where we are obliged to add this additional layer of complexity that is the non-distinct investment component.
Again, just 2 points here. I was the one who mentioned this is for reinsurance because it regards to the type of cash flow decomposition analysis based on contingency of claims here. So this word, contingent on claims, if you search the whole standard, it's only in that paragraph for reinsurance. And this paper specify how it should be done. You know, it's not in the standard. So I really hesitate there to broaden this kind of analysis to other businesses here. That's the first point. The other point I want to make is in the Hong Kong TRG discussion, some people raise concern as to paragraph 27, whereby it say the commission by reinsurer is not an acquisition cost. But then in paragraph 32, it say it depends. You know, if the cedent promise something to the reinsurer to the extent that, you know, they will do the underwriting and claims and so on, then you may have a service provided to the reinsurer. So I think you need to consider that, of course, the facts and circumstances. If the cession, if the cedent cede the majority of risk, say 99% of risk go to the reinsurer, and in that case, the reinsurer has a dominant economic interest in making sure that that business is done in a way that aligns with what the reinsurer wants. And in that kind of situation, yeah, the commission could well be acquisition cost.
Francesco.
I only have one question, and that is, are you going to issue a new version of the pocket guide on insurance after today?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. No. Thanks.
Well, why is the question? Why?
Why?
Well, because it is out. It is out, and now we have accumulated more evidence that there is a need for guidance and education, and so I just wanted to understand whether that would be effectively the action that you're going to take or not.
The insurance pocket guide reflects the requirements in the standard, so there's no need to change for it. As we keep meeting here and discussing issues, we provide guidance. The TRG is an educational forum to start with, so we do provide guidance by having those discussions, by issuing the summary. I don't see an immediate need to update all the time the educational material that we provide, but if we will feel a need to develop more educational material, we will do that for everything. Not just this specific topic.
My perspective is that what has been coming out of the September TRG on reinsurance is very important. You have particularly heard today several members of the TRG saying that they see this guidance being derived from words that are not clearly visible, according to a number of members in the standard. You heard myself, Sally, Sai-Chung, others have said that. We also heard you say that actually this is not just an insurance. This is a general set of principles that apply also to insurance contracts. Again, that's an important point. I know that this is an educational component of the effort at SBE. However, the Pocket Guide initiative is a very good one, and I certainly personally encourage you to continue to do that. And given that we got so much more to say in the context of the pocket guide, my recommendation to you would be to consider a new edition.
So I think it's great that you've appreciated the pocket guide, which is one of our main attempts to gather a number of points together. I think the educational efforts we've been doing with IFRS 17 have been ongoing and will continue to be ongoing. So we're not going to react immediately after this meeting because who knows what will happen in the months after that. But at some point when the staff resources are, you know, we can look at how we consolidate all the educational stuff we have in here. But I think this year is not really very likely.
Just to note as well, the pocket guide is on reinsurance contracts held, and it does include the requirements for reinsurance contracts held that relate to amounts contingent on claims and amounts not contingent on claims. So that is there.
Okay, who's next? Anne?
You mentioned a couple of times that you've looked at the economics, and when I apply that to mandatory and voluntary reinstatements, I just don't agree that that's what you come up with. I think when you're talking about economics, you mean you've looked through all to the cash flows, because the economics of both the mandatory and the voluntary reinstatement are, I am as a reinsurer as are receiving premium to cover exposure that I'm going to provide. So that's the true economics of the situation. You've gone beyond that. So I disagree with that assertion that you're saying it's the economics. I don't think that's right.
In the specific fact pattern that we have here, that's a contract that cannot be terminated. So the coverage will be provided, whatever.
No,
happens.
It will not. If you've eliminated, if you've eaten
the specific fact pattern that we received, the contract cannot be terminated. I accept that different people see different things. So I think it's very important that we stick to the principle, the criteria. But in this specific fact pattern, the contract cannot be terminated. I did not determine this fact pattern. I did not enter into this transaction, but this is it.
Okay, because the way that cat covers work and any other, you know, contract that is, you know, out there in the real world, when you exhaust your limit, yes, you are not terminating the contract. The contract continues in existence, but you do not have coverage because you've exhausted the limit and no further claims can be made and recovered. So whether you cancel it or not, it doesn't matter economically because you do not have a limit against which to claim.
But again, man, I think what I said from the beginning, I think if we're discussing different fact patterns, I think it is very, very dangerous because then all the observers of this meeting getting wrong things because we giving kind of educational guidance which different fact patterns, which is not helpful. I think if we stick to what is in the standard and not saying what is in practice come, maybe it is come different things, but we receive the submission for the specific fact patterns and we try to answer the question for a specific fact pattern. And we should not, and I said it all the time, we should not by kind of on the rush here really discussing different fact patterns, because I think we have not, at least I have not thought about that in detail and cannot give guidance. And therefore it is dangerous because this THG should give some kind of help, guidance to others, and we should not confuse others. We should give guidance and not confusing people. And therefore, I would really ask you, stick to the fact patterns and not really discussing different things with kind of, maybe small things will change the accounting outcome. But that is a risk, and man, I'm working now 6 years in this organization, and we should stick to that, because otherwise you come into wrong conclusions.
Even within that fact pattern, I would say
Mary.
The same applies.
I would say the same as well, okay. Even in that fact pattern. Can I just one more
Mary,
question?
Mary.
Okay. Sorry.
I will try very carefully to stick to this fact pattern. And this particular fact pattern seems to me to have led to clearly lively discussion on commissions and reinstatement premiums. But I believe it has also led to very helpful clarification around how we should read the definition of an investment component. Mm-hmm. And I would really welcome it if that could be carried forward into the summary of this discussion, because I think that is clearly on point for these facts and circumstances.
Okay. Azuka?
Just picking up on that, because that was my other question. Again, the way that the analysis goes about whether you make a decision if an element is an investment component or not is linked with whether there has been effective payment and then repayment is something that I wanted to ask the staff about, because it is a general common practice in the relationship between cedent and reinsurer that you only settle net. And in addition to that, very often you've got contracts where the,
the cedent does not transfer effectively the premium, but retains it as a funds withheld, but it is viewed as paid by the reinsurer, no matter that it physically has not been paid as a transfer from the cedent to the reinsurer. So in these cases, would you interpret it as paid and therefore potentially qualifying or not?
I'm not sure that I got your question. Is it about meeting the definition of investment component?
Yes, because you guys are saying that it has to be effectively paid first and then be repaid in order to qualify.
If talking in simple terms, investment component is usually a deposit element, something that carries a financial aspect to it. If there is no such financial aspect, if there is no such deposit element, everything is settled net at the first day, I don't see any investment component. Because if you think about it, you need to identify usually investment components as you incur claims. I don't see how you can do that. It's not that we determine the accounting based on the timing of cash flows, but timing of cash flows is really relevant of whether you have investment component or not.
But isn't it maybe, again, random-wise discussing things, which I think was not the topic of this paper. Okay. And Kevin?
I was just going to say, I think the paper is clear that whether it's paid net or paid and paid back doesn't change the accounting. Yeah. You still have the revenue of a certain number. It's just whether it's investment component or not.
So if, again, exactly in that context, if you have not physically settled but you have withheld the net because it's in your favour, so the premiums that you pay at the beginning are less than, you know, commissions or claims, so you just haven't physically paid, it's funds withheld.
So you're referring to a situation that instead of settling net, you receive and pay back money, so you just don't call it net, but it happens on the same day?
It happens on the same day, you just physically do not pass it.
I think it happens on the same day, and net for the purpose of investment component works the same way. And I don't want to create more guidance by talking about this more than the words in the standard are saying. So,
I think these are questions that I've received from the industry. That's why I felt I needed to raise them, because the guys wanted me to.
At the beginning of this meeting, when we should not use this. Anybody has questions in implementation, nitty-gritty stuff, and we should not use this forum to, which I think can solve and then be dealt with in practice. And that is not a kind of Q&A forum, it is a kind of submissions which we received, and then we try to get an answer. And I think when we also, in the preparation of this meeting, decide, okay, what is helpful for us in education, what is maybe clearly can be done, but it is not a Q&A forum for all kind of questions which people might have. Sorry that I had to say that again, but now I think we have to go to lunch, or should go to lunch.
For one more minute.
Okay, so what I think I heard was that generally the TRG members agreed with the analysis in the paper, which is based on the economic effects. This paper clarifies that we are giving consistent principles to reinsurance contracts issued that we've got for reinsurance contracts held. Applying what we've got, it's got practical implications for implementation because it's different to existing practice. And it'll also have an impact on the metrics and ratios that insurers use. And then the final point I've got down is that there's helpful clarification around the definition of an investment component. And that when we say repaid in all circumstances, we're also talking about on termination.
Perfect.
Okay, thank you, Laura. Now we have lunch. Lunch is in the kitchen, I think.
At the end of the long corridor.
End of the corridor, and we are back at 1:45. Thank you.